Hello, Walkstars. I am so looking forward to sharing this episode with you. I am currently on the road, so we're just doing this as a solo episode. I am speaking with an extraordinary author, Alyssa Altman. I've admired her work from a distance for a long time, and here we actually get to speak in person about the power of walking and the power of writing from a place of uncertainty. I so look forward to hearing what you think. Come on over to Instagram and let us know. Enjoy this episode and have a great walk.
Blind Nil Audio.
I'm Alex L.
I'm Libby Delena. Welcome
to This Morning Walk Podcast.
Good morning, Alyssa.
Good morning, Libby.
Welcome to This Morning Walk Podcast. I said to you earlier before we started recording that I was kind of a little bit nervous. And the reason I was nervous is I so love your writing so much. And you and I have been communicating, I don't know, how long about walking?
I would say 5 years, something like that. And I have to thank you so much for having me on. It's just a thrill. And I love everything that you write and post and talk about, and, you know, and someday I will plunge, but not just yet.
Fair enough. Oh my gosh, to have you say that out loud is, I guess it's the Mutual Admiration Society. So thank you for joining. I'm so sorry Alex couldn't join us. I know she feels equally the same love affair that I do.
No,
but
that's wonderful. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. And I'm trying to remember what it was that prompted me potentially originally to reach out. I think, were you writing about walking? I'm trying to remember the specific thing that made me brave enough to reach out to someone I so admire on a whim.
Thank you. I don't remember. Maybe I had quoted, Lauren Elkins.
Oh, yes.
About walking. I also, what is the Latin quote?
Everything solved by walking.
Everything is solved by, right. Salvator ambulando.
Ambulato. Yes.
And I had used that in Motherland. I had used that quote in Motherland. And yes, then the people who run PEG and all, Margot Kent, one amazing company, amazing. She actually started creating jewelry that said Salvator Ambulando. And so maybe that, I think I had written about it. So,
you know, those of us who love walking, we find each other. We just can't help it. So here we are.
Here we are.
So I, you know what, I'll do my best to sort of tell our walk stars who you are, but I probably will gush. Who knows? I may get choked up. Who's to know? We'll find out. But I am so excited to have Alyssa Altman here today with us. She's the author of Motherland, a memoir of love, loathing, and longing. And to be perfectly honest, that title, we'll get to this, but that resonated so much. You are also the author of a critically acclaimed TRAFE, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw. Again, a title that somehow when I saw that, before I had read a word, I felt like, oh, this is a place where I need to spend some time. And quite honestly, and you are the author of Poor Man's Feast, a love story of comfort, desire, and the art of simple cooking, which is, if I'm correct, a James Beard award-winning blog also.
Yeah, right, the blog that was connected to it. Yeah. Thank you.
Right. And I think, I don't know how long ago this came out, you were on a podcast with Debbie Millman, who said, said something along the lines of, no one writes about food, familial relationships in the incredibly insightful way that you do. I don't know that I've quoted her entirely correctly, but I would second that your writing about food sits right next to MFK Fisher, who
thank you.
I mean, who I adore and was.
I'm done here.
The love fest continues. Well, you know, as someone who actually myself, I went to cooking school and met MFK Fisher and never got over how beautifully she wrote about food. It's when I started reading your blog that I thought, oh, wow, here's someone else who feels the same way.
Thank you so much, writes as
beautifully. So we have a lot to discuss. My first question to you, well, first off, I mean, golly, we're both walkers. We both love, I'll call it the art of walking.
Yes.
So my first question to you, what are you walking with right now? I mean, I know, you know, Motherland came out a little while ago. I think from your Instagram, you're in the midst of a new manuscript. So what are you walking with now? It can be both physical, it can be spiritual, whatever it is.
Great question. So Motherland came out originally in 2019, right on the heels of COVID. And then the paperback came out in 2021, just as COVID was ending, which is, I have to say, the marketing people at my publishers were just like, what did we do? We have no idea. But I've been working on a book called On Permission, and it is about creativity and permission and the permission that we give ourselves to make art in whatever form that art comes, whether we are bakers or cooks or painters or photographers, or certainly in my case, a writer. Writers, artists, playwrights, poets. I maintain that we are the art making species. I mean, that's something that Robert McFarlane has said, and I'm an enormous fan of his, the author of Underland and a bunch of other extraordinary things. And that Underland is sort of like my Bible. I mean, it's sitting right off to the side as I'm talking to you, but permission came about, and of course it's on permission on the broad, in the broader sense of the word as well. So what are the stories that we have permission to tell? What are the stories that we don't have permission to tell? What are we allowed to write about? What are we not allowed to write about? Where does that come from? What do our cultures say we can talk about versus, so it's, you know, it's at the macro level and the micro level. And the micro level is really sort of what I'm interested in, because it's something that every one of us faces, mostly women. And it came from, the book came out of an essay that I'd written for Krista Tippett's On Being blog back in 2016, and was connected to a situation that I very sadly found myself in after my first book came out in 2013. And Poor Man's Feast had come out. It was a linear book, love story. I met this person. I had to make a decision. Do I leave New York City? Do I not? What are the things that happened after I left? So I thought it was, with a little bit of backstory, and so I thought it was a pretty basic book, filled with love, filled with food, new relationships, old relationships. And about three quarters of the way through the book, in about eight lines towards the end, I told a story about my paternal grandmother, who in 1926 left her family for between 3 and 4 years. We don't have the exact dates. My father was 3. My aunt was was actually 8. And eventually, I mean, my grandmother came back, and then she became sort of a pariah in the family. Mothers don't leave their children.
Yeah.
In my culture, you know, we're always spoon-fed. Jewish mothers don't leave their children, which I think it's much broader than that. You know, and what I didn't know when I wrote the book, all parties are, you know, at this point are long dead, except for my aunt, who was in her late 90s. what I didn't know was that while the story was a story that I had been spoon-fed as a child, my father spent most of my young life trying to metabolize that grief by bringing it inappropriately or not to the dining room table. We talked about it over breakfast. We talked about it all the time. What I didn't know was that my aunt hid it from her family. So that was the way she metabolized it.
Yes.
And so the book comes out. There are 8 lines that blow the lid off this great family secret that I had no idea was a secret. And it turned my life upside down. I lost most of that that family. It was one of the most traumatic experiences of my life. They were like sisters to me. I was very close to them. And I think that they were, and to a large extent still are, so invested in creating this sort of veneer of beauty and love and perfection and all of those things, that was really more important to them, to maintaining that. And so, and my father was long gone at this point, but the question that came out of that was, do you know that a story is a secret if no one tells you it's a secret? How do you know you're allowed to write what you want, what you have to write about, what you have to write about? And it took me about, I would say like 2 years to get to the point where I could actually even, I couldn't have had this conversation with you right after it happened, because it was so traumatic. And so when when you talk about walking and what is it that I'm walking with now, I just turned the manuscript in to my publisher. It's going into copy editing now, which means that I'm at the, oh my God, what did I do point? Like,
What have I written?
And I teach a lot of workshops about this subject to workshoppers and students who range from National Book Award winning novelists who are stepping into memoir for the first time to new memoirists. And this is a question that touches everyone. Right. And so I would say for the first 2 or 3 years after it happened, every walk that I did, every hike that I did, was an attempt with every step to pull myself through this profound grief at losing these people who I loved. And I'm not shy about saying it's still love, very much. So that is what I'm walking with right now, and have been now for a while. That's why that quote, Salvatore Amulando, is so profound in my life.
Hey, Walk Stars. We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to this Morning Walk podcast. Oh, that's it's a really touching story, and I think obviously I don't know that sense of, I'll call it grief or uncertainty at that moment, but I'm glad you had your walking practice as a companion during that time.
Yeah.
And I think the concept, there's two things that have, several things that came to mind as you were talking about it. Number one is walking art. You talked about, people finding their craft in their, so that's one question. The other thing that really struck me is this notion of permission, and how is it that we are able to recognize or understand what truth are we allowed to speak out loud? How do we navigate? How do we understand? How do we, you know, I think it's hard for people to think they have permission to share very honestly about complicated relationships that they might have, especially with parents, especially mm-hmm. with family.
Does
it require permission to actually speak it out loud? Are there a variety of truths? So I think that's such a powerful inquiry about the act of creation and storytelling and what we are able to actually put, what words we are willing to put on paper, which actually brings me to your beautiful book, Motherland. I just, it is so powerful and so, I think the thing about it is that I couldn't help but be just in awe of your ability to speak the truth about what feels like certainly a very dynamic and complicated relationship. And back to permission, to be able to speak that out loud, Lissa, just is such exquisite bravery. And what I took away from it was just incredible bravery around being willing to speak that and write that. Can you tell us about what that process was like, or tell us about Motherland to begin with? It is one of the books, when I read it, I could hardly put it down.
Oh gosh. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. I mean, there's a really famous James Baldwin quote, which I know I'm going to mangle, about the fact that we all have one story to tell. Yes. And that story, no matter what we write, no matter what we create, yes. keeps getting retold over and over yes. and over again until it becomes larger, it gets smaller. The focus on it changes, the focal plane on it changes. And I knew, you know, very early on that I was going to write about my mother. My mother and I have had an extraordinarily complicated relationship. I would say from the word go, she didn't know she was pregnant with me for 6 months, which is, how does that happen? Lots of ways, you know. Yes. She was body dysmorphic. There was anorexia involved. And so, yeah, one of the questions that I fielded a lot when I was on tour was, well, how did she not know? Didn't she get her period? And you know, and I remember speaking to a group, and someone raised their hand and said, well, no, she probably had stopped getting it.
Exactly. And she was so, yes.
Because she was so slim. And I mean, slim is not, she was not slim. She was really not well. But so she didn't know she was pregnant with me for 6 months until she couldn't get her rings off and her fingers were swollen. And mm-hmm. a cousin of mine said to her, well, maybe you're maybe you're pregnant. And that was, and sent her off to the doctor. 16-year-old cousin had to tell her.
Yes, yes.
So, and then that became an issue of how is her body going to change while she's carrying a baby? And when I was born, I was 4 pounds. And which, you know, if you think about 4 pounds, and you know, supermarket chickens are bigger than right. 4 pounds.
A bag of flour,
heavier right. than 4 pounds. Right.
Right.
So I always wrote about her in some way, whether yeah. in my journals and notebooks. I had a year-long column with in the Washington Post mm-hmm. called Feeding My Mother, which was ostensibly about feeding senior citizens who don't like food, who will not be fed. But over the course of the year, I realized it was more about sustaining my mother and how could I sustain someone who would not be sustained. And sustenance comes in, you know, every form.
Yes.
So that was really where it had come from. And I had been speaking with an editor at Random House for a long time about it. And they offered me a book deal, and I, you know, was thrilled and honored to be there. And I was 6 months into writing what had been a very, very different book. And then my mother had a catastrophic fall. And so what, and I had to sort of toss that like first, 6 months of work.
Yeah.
But what I realized was, you know, what I had written about at the beginning, which was theoretical and in hindsight and conjecturing, and was suddenly put into real time. And mm-hmm. I was called to take care of her. I was called to be her caregiver. I had to take over her finances, which were a complete wreck. And so I had been sort of emotionally estranged from this person, you know, for years. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I found myself living with her day to day and dealing with medical issues and, you know, senior issues, which afflict every, you know, older person in this country. I don't care whether they, you know, they're wealthy or they're not wealthy. Everybody faces this.
Yes.
And so I had to go back and rewrite this book. And that was one of the most complicated things that I've ever had to do writing wise. Never a good idea to write a story of any kind while the story is unfolding, because it's like a lotus that starts to open and you have no idea where it's going to take you. None.
Right. How did you do that? I mean, how does one even do that?
That's, yeah.
What a craft.
It was really hard. And I think that the thing that was most helpful for me, and it's something that I teach a lot, is whenever we're writing memoir, we have to create ourselves as narrator, representative of us, but in fact, a character.
Yeah.
And we have to snip that connection, you know, between ourselves and the page, so that we're able to sort of step back and look down into the diorama of our lives, and see our lives as it's unfolding, and, you know, as it's unfolding with this other person. And when we do that, we're able to write with hopefully clarity and distance, but also fairness, because no one is a perfect person. Narrators aren't perfect people. There's that great Vivian Gornick quote, and I'm looking at my bulletin board to see if it's up there. So the great Vivian Gornick quote, which is, for the drama to deepen, we need to see the cunning of the innocent and the loneliness of the monster. And
oh, will you say that again? Oh,
for the for the drama to deepen, we need to see the cunning of the innocent and the loneliness of the monster. And that paragraph, those lines were the lines that allowed me to step into this story and write not from a place of revenge or not from a place of rage. Well, there was plenty of rage in the book, but not from a place of rage, but to try and write it from a place of humanity, and showing the lives of these two women who are aging in tandem.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that's most powerful is the way you write about mother-daughter dynamic is there's a, sort of this really exquisite, what feels like exquisite honesty that potentially allows more women to see their own complicated relationships with their mother in a way that is tender and caring and lovely. As you just said, you are able to put yourself in that role with fairness and humanity, and yet it remains complicated. It remains what it is. And, you know, you've used the word addiction when it comes to your mother, and the word loathing in the title. Those are powerful, powerful words, especially in the context of family and our mothers as daughters. Say more about that. How was it cathartic to write this? Was it, what, were you separated enough from the story that it wasn't about a healing moment? It was, again, about this telling of the story with recognition, honesty, respect, fairness?
Yeah, no, thank you. You know, it's what I tried to do, and I hope I accomplished it. I don't know, but is write with some degree of fairness. And my plan, it wasn't really a plan, but it was my hope that I was going to come out the other side of it with a different sense of who my mother is and who my mother was. And how she got to this place and how we got to this place.
Yes.
Early on, I remember when there was press about the fact that I was doing this book, I was writing this book, I had had a column in the Washington Post that was fairly popular. I'd been talking about my mother for a long time, writing about her for a long time. And one of the questions that was posed to me was, well, is this going to be like Mommy Dearest? And, you know, those of us of a certain age will remember Mommy Dearest, which was written by Christina Crawford about her mother, the actress Joan Crawford. And of course, there was a horrific movie made about it with Faye. I think Faye Dunaway played the lead role. And it was, I mean, it was just, it was terrorizing and terrifying. And I was so surprised when this person asked me that question, because I thought that, you know, that there's no way that that's, you know, I wasn't trying to seek revenge or to try, you know, what I wanted to do was I wanted to gain some level of clarity on who this person is and who they were and how they got to the place where they are now. And the arc of their life in terms of disappointment and how do we metabolize constant disappointment. I think that some people are more, they're better equipped to deal with the vagaries of everyday life, which includes, of course, regret and disappointment. And some people are not. And she has not been able to do that. And then also to try and understand my own responses to her and to growing up in a home with someone who suffers from fairly severe mental illness. My mother's been clinically diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, which is not, you know, it's not treatable. It's certainly not curable, but it's not treatable. And it makes for, I think, a very lonely existence for that person. But that was really what my goal was to try and understand who these two women were and are, and to give myself the permission to ask those questions in a way that was not salacious. And not vengeful, but to just really try and understand, and hopefully in a way that would sort of peel back layers for other adult daughters, estranged adult daughters. You know, my mother and I still have a very, very complicated relationship. Before we hit the record button, I told you that I literally had to take my phone off the hook, because I told my mother that I was going to be in this conversation with you, and hung the phone up, and instantly she called back, because that's what NPDs do, you know. But to have, you know, to have the permission to recognize my life as the daughter of someone living with a profound mental illness, and also to look at her and think, she's living alone. She's been living alone now since 1997, and she's an enormously strong woman. She just is. And very few people have ever told her that. She doesn't feel that about herself. And I never really had I never really thought about her that way until I'd written the book.
Well, I would say that as I read it, I felt exquisite compassion and honesty at the same time, which is a really beautiful balance. I don't feel, I certainly having not lived the life, I don't know, but it felt as if you were willing to, you know, tell the full story. And that was part of the inquiry to your own life and your life together. Right. And I guess I just wonder, you know, I heard you say, I think in an interview or perhaps either a podcast or an interview, that to wait for permission to tell one's story, and you, I think you noted, especially if one is a woman, is to wait forever. And the idea that why is it that we don't give ourselves permission to tell these stories? Or what? Say more about that notion that to give ourselves permission to tell these stories means that we might wait forever, and especially women. I wonder what that is.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are the caregivers. You know, we are the nurturers, where we are culturally, that is who we are. And, you know, going back to, to the garden, if you believe in the garden, that has been historically the place of women in our culture and society. You take that to another step, women of color have absolutely, I mean, you know, the question of permission for women of color has until recently really rarely been posited, because it was just understood that, well, you don't really have permission to say anything, you know, so, right. You know, so we don't really want to, you know, we're not even going to think about that. And that is, of course, a profound tragedy. That's a profound tragedy. Yes. And, you know, and then you hear, you know, stories of, you know, women like Sojourner Truth and of course, these are the stories that have to be told. And and no one was going to give, women of color back then, you know, any permission. And that really hasn't changed very much. But I think that we tend to second guess ourselves. We don't want to make waves. We don't want to ruffle feathers. We don't want to be the problem makers. We are often the carriers of the truth, but we want everything okay. Everybody needs to be okay, you know, and we put ourselves last, and we put our own stories and our own myths last. The number of people the number of women I've known who've gone through their lives without being able to write or make art that expresses their stories is, it's enormous. And as a result of that, you know, all of my workshops, most of my workshops and most of my classes tend to skew a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had a very well-known National Book Award winning author in one of my workshops. And when she showed up, I was like, oh my God, what are you, what are you doing here? You know? And she was wonderful and lovely and brilliant as always, as ever. And I said to her, and I said to the whole group one day, you know, what is it that is keeping you from writing your story? And she said, well, I don't want to upset my family. I don't want to turn over the apple cart. And then it came out that the family that she was worried about upsetting was like dead for 150 years.
Oh, so that's something still.
Then it becomes like, you know, a historical thing. I don't want to be the person to overturn the apple cart, much less set it ablaze, you know?
Yes. Yes. No, isn't that amazing? 100 years and it still felt that way. That's how deeply embedded it is. Was there any point in writing this book or even your new book where there was sort of exquisite resistance that you had to break through? And I guess the second part of that question is, if the answer is yes, was it possible that walking was at all part of that creative process to, I love your word, metabolize? Is it to get to a place where there might have felt a barrier? How did you work through that? Where were the sort of little pockets that enabled you to work through the places that felt scratchy and prickly and hard?
Yeah.
Where was that?
Well, you know, I have to preface that, the answer to that, by saying that the whole idea of writing a book connected to my workshops, but the whole idea of writing a book that came out of the trauma that I had experienced by being excised by my family of origin, who I adored and, you know, loved. I was like, wait a minute, what am I doing? Am I doing this all over again? Giving myself permission to write about permission was a really difficult thing to do. And it was, I maintain it's the most complicated and probably the hardest book I've ever had to write and story that I've had to tell, because I had to write it in context. I couldn't just write a how-to book. Right. There was a lot of like, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, it was like walking, but walking on broken glass. Uh-huh. Very, very precarious and very painful. And wherever I stepped, there was going to be more blood, you know, what was going to be terrible. Mm-hmm. And I did everything that I could, you know, to sort of pull my way through the story and this sort of unpacking of what creative permission means, through the lens of my own experience, certainly, but also through the lens of a lot of other, the experiences of other women writers, people like Honor Moore and Mary Carr and Doris Lessing and Danny Shapiro, people like that. And, With the knowledge that at the end of the day, when I had a book come out, it was going to be ripping the Band-Aid off, you know, again. So that was very hard. I have an extraordinary publisher, not the same publisher I've had in the past, but a much smaller publisher that really specializes in fairly literary works and poetry, and they were amazing. And I have just a great editor, very sensitive to the time that it was going to take me to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And in terms of walking, you know, we spend a lot of time in Maine. Susan and I spend a lot of time in Maine, and we do a lot of walking there. This last year was a little bit more complicated. There were knee problems and back problems and hip problems. Mm-hmm. Welcome to my sixth decade.
Yes,
you know? But walking, whether it was in Maine, by the water, by the ocean, and I'm a Cancerian, so I am very drawn to water and to the moon. Mm-hmm. And if it's a full moon and I'm by the ocean, forget it. All bets are off. But I found myself walking in a way that can only be described as meditative. And you know, my wife and we've been together for 25, it'll be 25 years next January. And she did walking meditation with Thich Nhat Hanh in Washington, D.C. in the, I want to say the 90s, around the reflecting pool and to the war memorial. So she's certainly very familiar, you know, with that, but it was not intentional on my part. According to my doctors, I was supposed to be walking very quickly, but that didn't really happen because I think, you know, apart from the fact that I'm really small and my strides are about like about that big, I just needed to move my body forward. And if I was going to be writing about these difficult stories and scenarios, I needed to keep moving my body forward. And, you know, my grandmother was a great walker, and I actually haven't written about that, but my mother's mother was a tremendous walker and walked probably 3 miles every day into her 80s. Mm-hmm. My mother, before her accident, walked from the Upper West Side where she lives to the East Side where I lived, and then back again, you know, probably 5 miles a day. So this was very much a thing for us. And I always knew while I was writing that I was getting into a place of trouble if I didn't want to walk.
You know, interesting?
If I, you know, Susan would say, let's go for a walk. Let's take the dog for a walk. You know, the dog has to walk. Let's walk.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'd be like, I just can't do it. I just can't do it. And that became really reflective of my own mindset and my own heart while I was, you know, digging back into the story of excision and the things we're allowed to tell and the things we're not allowed to tell.
Wow. That's a very powerful story. And I'd like to hear about your grandmother's walking sometime. Will you please write a piece on that?
Yes, I will. Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Well, here's the thing. You know, I've spoken with many people about walking, and, you know, people have certainly said it's meditative, it's spiritual, it's healing, it's obviously physical and creative, you know, a time for introspection, maybe even a place for innovation. And I think in my conversation with you right now, is walking art? Is there a place where we can hold that simple activity as a creative expression? I have often found it a place to be creative, mm-hmm. but I don't think I, until this conversation, ever thought of it as its own creative expression. As an act, it is artful. And I don't know what I mean by that. And maybe this is for another conversation for you and me, but what are your thoughts on that?
That's really extraordinary. I mean, I have not really ever considered that, but I think that, you know, when you think about what was the moment that, you know, when humans stood up on, you know, and took a step forward and took another step forward. And certainly, you know, when we look at babies and, you know, we have a new baby in my family who's my little cousin is, too, and I remember that moment of like watching her going, you know, am I gonna grabbing on? And she was just like, I just want to walk. Everybody, get out of my way. I just, you know, and I think that there is absolutely art to that as well. I would be very curious, and I'm sure studies have been done about this, and maybe, you know, we can go back into our own corners after our conversation is over, and you'll research it and I'll research it and we can come back together at some point. But I would be very curious about neurologically, do the same brain centers light up when one is making art, writing, painting, you know, whatever it is, singing.
Right.
Do the same brain centers light up as they would when you're walking? Has that ever been studied? You know, I think we need to talk to Dr. Amen about that. You know, and I'm sure that you know he would know. But I'd be really curious about that. And you know, when I think about art and walking, you know, I'm a huge fan of Myra Kalman's, and she still lives in the city in the village. And I remember reading about her saying that when she gets stuck creatively, and Myra Kalman actually gets stuck creatively, which is
hard to believe.
There's no hope for the rest of us. You know, that she will go out for a walk, and the act of walking sort of combs out the knots that she's running into, and whether it's being in the city and being surrounded by other people and sensory issues and stimulus, textures, yeah, and colors and, you know, the olfactory and in the aural, you know, A-U-R-A, maybe that has to do with it. I don't know, but I would be very surprised if it didn't, you know.
I would agree. You know, I've always sort of felt that as I go out for a walk, if I have something that I'm trying to solve, I visualize this sort of beautiful, literally a knot, a ball mm-hmm. of thread or string or yarn, all sort of. And as I walk, it just gently loosens. Mm-hmm. It just, each thread becomes its own entity, such that I can begin to identify each thread. When it's all together, it's one entity. You can't possibly see the structure, yeah, of the details. But as we walk, we begin to hold space, put a little space around each, and be able to identify what it
is.
That's
great. I love that. I love that image. Yeah.
It's certainly a creative process, but it's also, I always say that by adding motion to my emotions, I can understand them. Otherwise I have no idea.
That's great. That's wonderful.
But how about if we do this? How about if you and I will go back to our studio, we'll do some research, and a year from now, we'll have this conversation again. And
I would love to. That'd be great.
Such an interesting question. I mean, we certainly hear stories of, I've heard stories of Virginia Woolf and certainly Steve Jobs, who used as one of their most powerful tools was going for a walk to mm-hmm. solve all sorts of things. But it's a really, really interesting question. Thank you for raising it. And
absolutely.
Thank you for joining me. I have to say, this is a dream come true. I'm not sure what I'm going to do for the rest of the week, except go for a walk and be grateful that you joined me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I'm really honored that you asked me. So thank you.
Will you tell everybody where we can find you and how we can keep an eye out for this next beautiful book?
Thank you. Yeah. So I have a very fairly active Substack presence. And that's poormansfeast.substack.com. And my website is alyssaaltman.com. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook a little bit less than I used to be. Thank everybody or whoever's up there. Right. Because, you know, Facebook can get very swampy.
Great description.
And the book right now is scheduled for early 2025. So, as we get closer, I mean, you know, it can be pre-ordered, which, you know, as any author will say, is a, you know, we're not just hawking our books when we say that. There's actually a reason for pre-orders, and, print quantities have to do with it. And, you know, but it's out there. And I just really look forward to continuing this conversation and to walking with you. You have to walk really slowly though, because I know you're very tall.
It's true. You know what? We'll meet each other where it feels great to both of us, but thank you so much. And we will certainly, share out with our walk stars when your book comes out. And really, thank you so much. I think it was, however many years ago, I just reached out and because I admired you so. So I'm really grateful you're here. And
thank you for this conversation.
And everybody, I really recommend that you get Motherland. It's an absolutely beautiful story. As I said, it's told with compassion and honesty. And they are the stories we need to tell and hear. So thank you. You're the best.
Thank you, Libby. It's great to talk to you.
This Morning Walk is a production of Blind Nil Audio, hosted by me, Alex L.
And me, Libby Delena, produced and edited by Chris Jacobs.
If you find value and meaning in the conversations that Libby and I have, please share the show with a friend and consider leaving a 5-star review. Comments on Apple Podcasts really help us out. When you do that, it introduces this show to a bigger audience. Thank you so much for listening.
You are wonderful. Have a great walk.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nell Audio, nor Magnolia.